We're talking about social justice, and we've kind of looked at the foundations of Christian social justice, and we're talking about this in the context of immigration because we read the news. So it seemed to be an appropriate thing to talk about. So, excuse me, we have been talking about individual versus group rights, which is one of the bases on which you kind of wrestle with social justice issues. What are the rights of the individual? What are the rights of the group, the society, and how do you balance them? So in terms of immigration, as I mentioned last week, you have the rights of the individual immigrant, asylum seeker, refugee, which all of which are different things, versus the rights of the society, the nation. But then you also have the right of the individual citizen of the nation versus the group rights of those who are not citizens of the nation.
What organization did you say, I forgot exactly how you put it, decreed that somebody who is escaping from political turmoil or is in danger?
The United Nations.
Okay, the United Nations?
Yes. That's a United Nations declaration that anyone who is escaping, who is in fear for their life, has the right to claim asylum, and that anyone who is fleeing violence, that there is a way to deal with refugees. And so you've probably heard of the United Nations High Commission for Human Rights.
Did you mention that?
Yes, yes. Yeah. And then there's also a United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And the High Commissioner for Refugees, part of, I don't remember if it's a him or her right now, but part of the job of the commissioner is to oversee the setting up of refugee camps in areas where they're needed. So when you hear on the news that there are 100,000 people who fled from Burma/Myanmar and there are refugee camps in Thailand, it is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees who oversees that. Now, they don't have a lot of employees themselves. They tend to contract with they're called NGOs, non-governmental organizations. You've heard of some of them. World Vision is one that come in and set up. And
do they
actually
have money? Do they have funds?
A lot of their funds come from the United Nations.
Okay.
And then, of course, some of them also do fundraising on their own. So, but a lot of the funds for the refugee camps are grants from the United Nations to the organization that's actually on the ground doing the work. The Red Cross also sets up, and the Red Crescent set up.
Does the country where they settle have a right of say in whether they settle there? Is that where the thing comes in?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Technically, a nation who is a signatory to the Charter on Refugees is required to accept refugees, except that there are ways to put limits on that. They're not required to allow them out of the camps, although some nations do. But Jordan is a great example of this. When the Syrian civil war started 10 years ago now, Jordan was flooded with Syrian refugees because the borders are right there. And there are no mountains between Syria and Jordan. To the extent that there were as many people in refugee camps in Jordan as there were citizens of Jordan. And the king of Jordan, who is actually a very progressive guy, said, hey, wait, you know, we do not have the resources to do this. We're maxed out and beyond maxed out. These people have to go somewhere else. And so now they've closed the border between Syria and Jordan, so that is no longer a border that you can cross.
So that's what created the influx of people
going the other way, going through Turkey and then then into Europe or North Africa and into Europe, because they couldn't get across the Syrian-Jordanian border anymore. And that's a really good example of you know, you have the right of people to seek refuge, and yet the right of the nation in which they're seeking refuge to say, hey, wait, stop, you know, we can't do this anymore. And where, when do you get to draw that line?
That was what I was just going to ask. You know, mm-hmm. how do you know when you've reached that point? Like there's mm-hmm. Hungary and mm-hmm. the various other countries saying enough. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So is there a legal limit?
Mm-hmm. And does it depend on the infrastructure of the nation to which they're seeking refuge?
Right.
You know, does a nation with more infrastructure have a greater, you know, do we take the to whom much is given, much is required? If you have more, you're required to give more. Yes. That's certainly the one of the founding principles of the United Nations. It's called differentiated responsibility, which means that if contributions to the United Nations are based on the gross national product of the nation. So if you're a wealthier nation, you have to give more.
And it seems like who can decide what the justification is for refusing? Because that's what's going on now. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. just being decided by a political mm-hmm. issue rather than, mm-hmm. you know, saying we have too many refugees.
Right. Mm-hmm. Technically, the government of the nation is empowered to say, to decide when they've reached their nation's limit of people they can accept. So,
but do they need to justify it? Oh, I'm sorry.
In the case of Jordan, mm-hmm. when they decided that they could not mm-hmm. bear to take anymore, mm-hmm. How did they prevent the people just from walking in anyway?
They have their army stationed at the border.
Oh, okay.
It's not
build the wall, huh?
Well, they have built some barriers in places
but
that
it's a smaller place.
It's a small you're being facetious, in some parts of the border they did build a wall because it's a 300-mile border, mm-hmm. but it's a 300-mile border, mm-hmm. and so there are some places where there's a wall. And there's some places mm-hmm. where a wall wouldn't make any sense, mm-hmm. Where they have razor wire and soldiers, and then there are places where there are actually ports of entry through the wall, but they don't allow refugees through. You have to have a pre-assigned visa. You can't just show up and say,
I saw an article yesterday that Mexico allows all refugees to mm-hmm. come in.
Yeah,
even though Mexico is limited in resources mm-hmm. and traveled economically.
How many immigrants go in?
Oh, South America is a big mess now.
So yeah.
Many, many people.
From South and Central America.
From South America.
Yeah. That's where the caravan comes from.
Yeah. I know they came from south of
Guatemalans.
Yes, yeah. And that was the political decision in Mexico, is we're looking around and we have so we can give. Mm-hmm. It's really very interesting.
Why didn't the refugees stay there in Mexico?
Mexico isn't exactly a safe nation. Particularly right around the U.S. border, mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of gangs and violence there. Mm-hmm. And even in Mexico City, there's quite a lot of gangs and violence.
I'm not sure how many, you know, like if they want to live there permanently, I'm not sure mm-hmm. how many mm-hmm. higher level jobs are available there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because a lot of Mexicans are out of work.
There was a woman mm-hmm. on TV this morning that said she was working as a dishwasher. She came from Honduras, earning $2 a day. Mm-hmm. But she said in Honduras, I was homeless. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So right. for her,
also, admitting someone as a refugee does not necessarily mean you're giving them the right to work.
No. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of nations do not allow people who are seeking refuge, who are refugees within their borders, to work. Often they aren't allowed to enter leases. They have to stay in the refugee camps. So Mexico is rare in that they allow refugees to work.
It's where the working visa comes in.
Mm-hmm. So,
and isn't it the government of Mexico a new one and they're trying harder to fix things?
Yes. Yes, there's a new president in Mexico who is attempting to assert control over
gangs.
And, you know, Mexico is one of the places that has had an issue of the gangs, and particularly narcotics gangs, having as much money as the government.
And power.
And power. And so that's, you know, that's a problem when the criminals are as well armed as the soldiers.
And we sort of went through that in the, you know, with the Al Capone and everything.
Yes. We knew we had to handle it. Yes, when we outlawed, particularly when we outlawed alcohol, there was a large demand for it, and so all of the people who were producing alcohol and selling it were doing it illegally, and all of a sudden, the gangs who were doing that are as powerful as the government, which is part of the reason that we repealed the amendment about prohibition, because the government looked around and went, you know,
not really.
Seemed like a good idea at the time, but maybe not.
Exactly.
Well, and this is the conversation with marijuana, because marijuana is one of the things that we produce that you can grow in the United States. You don't have to import it, right? So this is one of the part of the conversation about it is, well, you know, if we made that legal, there would be a lot less crime, because it wouldn't be a crime to, and maybe that would be a better thing. So
contract prisons.
So that's, but those are the balancing acts when you talk about social justice. Is where do you draw the lines?
So that's group. Getting rid of drug laws so that there's less crime. Literally. But the individual has more access to addiction.
That's right.
And so the individual has the opportunity to suffer more.
But they also have the freedom to make their choice.
Yes, exactly.
The way it depends when you look at it.
That's right. So and that's
the balance.
The balance.
Right.
Yep. All right. Let's move on and talk about the second point of, as you look at ethics of justice, which is taking into consideration ingrained and historic injustices. So, as we look at the refugee situation, looking at ingrained and historic injustices, or the immigration situation, I want to be careful with my terms. And we've talked before about how there are historic injustices in U.S. immigration law that preferenced Western Europeans over the rest of the world, and then later on preferenced all Europeans over the rest of the world. And it's hard to look at that and not say that that had a basis in racism and so. But how do you balance wanting to address ingrained and historic injustices with public policy? So where's the justice angle in there?
Well, in some cases it seems obvious, like slavery or women's rights. It all seems obvious. So the laws have to.
And looking back now, people are embarrassed about refusing the Jewish children,
interning the Japanese.
Interning the Japanese. And the Chinese Exclusion Act is something that we don't teach with pride in to our children.
We don't teach Native American history.
We don't. No.
I mean, we don't teach it.
No.
It's not that we don't teach it equally.
Right.
We don't touch it.
We used to.
It's hidden.
But I think it was kind of a
revised history we taught. I used to teach it.
So yes, we certainly don't teach that our founding fathers were immigrants, right? We talk a little bit about the Native nations that were here, and then kind of there's a gap, and then we talk about, you know, the Mayflower and the settlers, and then there's a gap and we talk about colonial America. We don't actually teach. Oh, wait.
Colonials were such a wonderful thing to be. We celebrate them.
And then you go to Africa, and one of the worst things you can be called is a colonizer.
Yes, didn't somebody just call the French in terms of taking advantage of their African wealth? Mm-hmm. Just gesture on the paper.
So there's that piece. If you look at our current immigration debate, it's easy to talk about kind of where we are now without talking about how we got here. We've kind of brushed over, oh, well, Central America is such a mess. Well, how did Central America get to be a mess?
The United States did it.
We did a lot of intervening in the governments of Central and Southern America, South America. Are we responsible to some point? And then what responsibility do we have?
You can't take responsibility until you publicly acknowledge that you had a hand in it. Mm-hmm. And nobody acknowledges that. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody in power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in power. Mm-hmm.
So there's, you know, as we talk about ingrained and historic injustice, what's the, you know, we are actually very upset with the idea of somebody intervening in our political process, right?
Yes.
We have investigations about it, and we're all up in arms about it. Have we taken responsibility for where we've intervened in others' political processes far more openly than, I mean, the CIA used to kidnap Central American leaders and push them out of planes.
Oh, we're so wonderful.
Yes. So.
We act like the papacy infallibly.
There we go.
So, how do we take that historic injustice and apply that as we look at our immigration policy? What do you think?
I think you have to educate people first. That's one of the objections I have with what's going on now is I don't think, you know, we blame the leaders without realizing they were put there by people who are, I think, misunderstanding it. And so I expect the leaders to turn around and say, this is why it's wrong. This is why we're doing what we're doing. But I don't get that. They just sort of stick to what these people
misunderstand.
You know, well, it's not always misunderstanding. I mean, we all coming from a direction we think is the right way. But I think, you know, when you're against what they call elite, which I think are people who are taking into consideration the history, justice, you know, who see the nuances of everything, I feel like the leaders need to turn around and just try to say, this is why we're doing this. This is where, this is what they're feeling. This is why they're feeling what they're feeling. You know, maybe tell why the other side is feeling.
And you're talking about power leaders.
I think, you know, even your representative. I think, you know, if they, because I know, you know, they go home. They, you know, I used to, as I was on the school board, so I would lobby with them. And, you know, we would present our case, but they would come back and tell us what their perspective was, why they were doing what they were doing. I don't know if there's enough of that going on anymore. You know, whether they just, yes, it's fine, we'll do what you want.
A lot of people don't care anymore. They don't. I mean, just to call up Schumer and say, hey, you know,
and is it so much that you don't care, or is it that the life we lead today is different than the life we led 20 years ago? There's absolutely no flex time in anybody's schedule.
Well, I think you think you're not going to make a difference. That's a big
Well, that too, but you also have to have time basically to think.
To do it.
And then to push yourself to show up someplace to say something.
But nowadays it's a phone call, it's a Twitter, it's a... You could email, you could reach people longer, I think, more than you used to. You don't have to attend a town hall meeting. You know, but I think here, you know, when you have democratic leaders and you agree with them, you tend to, you know, okay, we're doing what I think
too,
I want to.
We're too, the opposite side. We're too comfortable.
And
I look at sports and how it just takes care of everything. You watch sports and everything's taken care of. And you don't have to think about anything else. Just wins the next game, wins the next other game.
Well, and I do think one of the things is we know a lot more now than we used to, and that increases the number of things that we care about, right? I mean, even even in the 1970s and 80s, really, the national news was on for a half an hour a day, and you knew what fit into that, or what was, if you were, you know, most people didn't subscribe to the New York Times, and you couldn't, there wasn't such a thing as online papers. So you knew what national stories were in your local paper, and you knew what was on
the nightly news.
And they had a half an hour, So they pick.
Sound bits.
Right?
Yeah, now it's on all day.
Right. And so now.
Repetitious.
Yeah. There's a lot more sources for news, too, right? You know, I can go on Twitter and find out what's going on in Egypt or Africa or, you know, pick, as well as kind of all over the nation, right? In ways that even 20 years ago, you couldn't really know as much. And that's great, because now I know a whole lot about what's going on, but how do I decide what I care enough about
to do something about?
And also, how do I sustain the energy of interest in that?
Yes.
Because tomorrow there'll be something else. Mm-hmm. And...
Well, that's what I meant about the sports, but we're being entertained too much now. Mm-hmm. The movies, whatever, the machines, the little games. That's all you do is you sort of immerse yourself in being entertained. Entertain me. And that's and then we don't get serious about, you know, how lucky you are to live here or whatever and to do something about something for other people.
Mm-hmm. But also I think people feel powerless, you know, like especially with this stalemate between Trump and Pelosi and so forth, you know, the Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, what does your little Twitter have, is that going to have, you know?
Well, maybe, even if you got 100 people to go to the telephone and say something to Pelosi and or Trump or whoever, would it help? Mm-hmm. Even that many people saying something.
I think it does. Right. I think they
pay
attention to the people that call.
Gigi
like
is one that follows that line. Yes.
I think
they don't hear from the other people. They think everything's okay.
Yeah, I think there's another problem, too, that you know we have a lot of news sources, so you can sort of pick what you want to believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's a failure in education to teach people how to think critically,
to
find out what is really the truth, what is really the news.
But people are being bombarded, when you think about it, with advertising all the time.
Yes.
And they have no problem with that. You know, like they are bombarded by all these ads, telling them everything's great, and then they'll go out and buy a product believing it. Well, you need to be discerning, just as you are with what you hear on the news.
The small print is
critical,
too small.
Critical thinking, really.
Critical thinking, right.
Yeah. We have had an expansion of choice in a way that kind of snuck up on us, I think. I'm working on a book about spiritual practice. It's happened for a long time. It may eventually get off my hard drive and into a publisher's hands, but haven't
yet. You did a sabbatical.
Yeah, well, I took one and it didn't quite get all the way done. But anyway, one of the factoids that that I looked at is choice. And the average... If you go to Best Buy and want to put a stereo system together, a sound system together, at the Best Buy up the road, there are between 20,000 and 30,000 ways that you could put those components together to make a stereo system.
Really?
Yeah. So, that's one thing at one big box store. Mm-hmm. Right?
I'll never forget the picture on some magazine as a woman sitting in a shoe store, and there's all these red shoes on the floor. Choice.
So that's, you know, at some point, what do I choose?
And that's stressful.
It seems overload. Overwhelming, really. Yes. If you want to buy a new telephone, or I mean, I always ask my brother. Sometimes, I mean, I really feel I need help with a lot of these things.
I always ask my son. I need to go shopping. Will you go with me?
Yes. Right.
I mean,
I call my brother when I'm in the store when I'm buying a TV. Yeah.
As opposed to in the past when you rented your phones from the phone company and you had a choice of black or white, right?
Right.
Or short.
That was easier.
So, but people said we want other things.
These women's marches that have been taking place, I think they're very expressive and effective. You know, so maybe we should have a march like that, just in general, against this
The stalemate.
The stalemate. Yeah.
What was Buffalo's about? It was canceled because of the storm, but was it? Women's
rights?
Yes.
I was in Washington over the weekend.
Did you see
them? Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Washington.
I was walking right with them because we were walking down the mall.
Washington this weekend was an interesting thing because there was the Right to Life March, the March for Life.
Yes.
Then there was the Indigenous Peoples March, and then there was the Women's March.
And then Martin Luther King.
And then there was a Martin Luther King.
I missed the confrontation at the memorial. That was the date we went on. I think we went on Saturday. That must have happened Friday. But there were Right to Life things all over the ground.
And those marches took place in cities all over the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, every state had probably two cities with women's marches, so...
One of the other things
if we all mobbed Washington D.C.
like the '60s,
we used to do that. Because crowd all the streets.
It worked eventually.
I don't think as many women as they had before, but it was a impressive group.
No. Okay, it was so impressive.
Men were there, children.
There's a book. The author's name is Richard Florida. And if you if you're interested in this, I commend this book to you. The book is called The Big Sort, and it talks about one of the things that has happened in our nation. It's older now; it's more than 10 years old, I think. But what he talks about is since about the 1990s, we have been sorting ourselves into communities of like-minded people, and so. In ways that we didn't really used to. We used to live in kind of heterogeneous communities. But now, particularly with the expansion of suburban and exurban communities, people choose where they live. Maybe this isn't consciously, but we've broken ourselves out so that the people we live among are people who not only look like us or have about the same amount of money we do, but who think like us.
Well, wasn't that the same way with the immigrants? The Kaiser
towns? Yes.
Yes.
But it's expanded now. So that one of the things he talks about is how it's really possible in America, particularly if you have money, to live your life in such a way that you never have to encounter anyone with a different point of view.
Yes.
That you can... You can really build a bubble around yourself so that all of the political signs in your neighborhood are people you want to vote for, and all of the people who go to church with you have basically the same values you do, and all of the people you meet at the grocery store.
But I think that that's a historical human instinct. Because
comfort.
Lived in clans, you lived in tribes, and that was basically genetic. And then linguistically, you lived in neighborhoods where people understood what you were trying to express, because it was no fun trying to get somebody who had no clue what you were saying to sell you something. So I think we've always done that. I think that maybe our technology creates more insulation so that we don't really have to even attempt to go outside of our bubble if we don't want to.
Well, that's one of the real benefits of education, is to be around people who are different and study somewhere else and learn another language. And all those kinds of things are kind of being poo-pooed in colleges today.
Yes, the liberal arts thing is really attacked.
It's becoming a job training.
Yes.
Doesn't offer critical thinking and exposure to other cultures.
But even in the 50s and the 60s, it was, if you were a middle-class person and you went to college, you went someplace like Buff State for teaching, UB maybe for engineering or medicine or teaching, but you went for a reason to get a job. And when you told people in a conversation what you were going to study, they would say, oh, that's good, you'll be able to get a job right away, or that's a job that you'll always be able to have.
Yeah. It was always studying something else. You can't get a job in that. You can't get a job in that.
But that was a middle class. You were elite. If you had money, you went to school.
You went to Harvard because you could go to Harvard.
And that's a huge difference. And that's also a huge difference when you get out in the working population. If you had the liberty to go to Harvard or Yale or wherever, you had a totally different education and probably a whole lot more critical thinking going on. If you were from basic Buffalo.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You went to Buff State, became a teacher, and critical thinking was not on the program. It was what, how you taught and what you taught from the syllabus and what the laws were.
And then those people with the no exposure are the teachers of
exactly.
the future children.
Exactly.
So that's a big, that's a problem.
Yes.
A big problem.
Yes, it really is. It's a huge problem. And so you just kind of keep generating the mm-hmm. same old, and, mm-hmm. and the same misconceptions mm-hmm. that lead to border and mm-hmm. immigration misunderstandings.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about unintended consequences.
Yes.
When I went to college, and I think I'm maybe the first generation that this really happened to. I went to college in 1986.
In Ohio?
In Ohio. And when I went to college, I went thinking, I wasn't sure when I went to college whether I wanted to be an elementary school teacher or a physicist. And so I went in with both majors. And I was, by basically everybody I encountered, including education professors, tried to talk out of becoming a teacher because I could do the physics.
Oh, wow.
And if you can do that, you really should.
Yes.
And so that during the 1980s, the ranking of education majors in their class really fell, so that the kids who were
the brighter
kids, and largely it was because a lot more doors were open to women. And so really bright women who would have been teachers, because that was what you could do,
were
now discouraged from doing that and encouraged to do other things.
Those who can do other things do other things. Those who can't teach.
So you know, and so we were talking before about unintended consequences, and I do wonder about, you know, the unintended consequences of, you know, oh, well, you know, you can do something else. You should do something else. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, because I would go from my physics class, my first year my first semester in college, I was taking calculus and computers, was the math class I was taking. And then I also had to take math for elementary school teachers. And I was really pretty appalled that the people in my math for elementary school teachers class really did not have a grasp of basic algebra.
No.
And it's like, okay, you're in college, you're going to be a teacher, you really need to understand algebra.
Mm-hmm. They're saying, oh, I'm teaching kindergarten.
That's exactly what they said, is I'm only going to be certified through eighth grade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't need to know.
But now they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. They still don't.
Just for your own sake.
Well, and if you don't have a sense of numbers,
right?
How can you teach number sense?
Yes.
You know.
I always tell everybody, give me an alphabet, I can sort it out, but give me numbers and I panic.
So,
what's more interesting, you know, if you can do, you know, the math, the computer science, the physics, it's more interesting than, you know, elementary, you know, teaching, at least in my estimation. I mean, it all depends on what your
what satisfies you.
Yeah, right.
What gives you a
That's
zip.
Right. What's more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, but some people like children and
But also, you know, you're going to make a lot more money.
Yes, I was going to say, in the United States, the economics between physicists and teachers is quite a gap. And our emphasis is, how much do you make?
They were just saying that this morning because they were talking about public employees. The FBI had come out with a statement yesterday saying they needed money. And somebody this morning said, you know, our FBI people could make twice as much elsewhere. You know,
but they're choosing to serve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't want to downplay these people because they are choosing to use their talents in public service. But, you know, anybody who chooses to go into teaching or anything in the public sphere knows they're going to be making a lot less money, so they either this is all they can do or they have to be very dedicated.
And their ability to label things, like you have the FBI, so you're thinking of these people that probably are making a decent salary, maybe not as much as they could privately, but they're making a decent salary. The FBI also includes all the people that serve lunches in the cafeteria and clean the hallways and the bathrooms and stuff. They're not making that kind of money, but they're also not getting paid.
Yeah.
and they're just sort of swept under the rug, the lower levels of all of these.
Not to change the subject, but religion. Okay. How much responsibility for division is now, because I see it more, is religion taking in dividing people and pointing out, you know, being judgmental and playing up differences?
Well, I think religious
immigration and other, you know.
I think religion has always played into the sense of the other. I mean, we can talk about Jewish-Christian debates. We can go further back and talk about, when we were talking about tribalism, you can talk about the tribal gods. You can talk about the Protestant and Catholic wars that divided Europe for two centuries. You all probably have memories of the Protestant and Catholic divisions in the United States. And now, of course, we have, and it's really since our immigration laws changed in the 1970s, to bring back to immigration, that we also have large percentages of people who aren't Protestant, Catholic, or Jewish, right, who are Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist or, you know, Sikh. So we now have more, visibly more, diversity in religion. But the other thing that's happened, and it kind of goes in two different ways, religion has become paradoxically both less important in public life and more important in public life. Less important in that it is no longer assumed that everyone belongs to a community of faith. And if you talk to people who were in the military, particularly until about the 1970s, you got told when you enlisted, particularly if you were going to be an officer, that you really needed to be Presbyterian or Episcopalian if you wanted to reach high rank in the officer corps, because that was how that worked. And that if you were going to be a lower ranking person, then it was okay to be Baptist or Catholic or Methodist. But as you moved up the ranks, you probably needed to think about
what church you sat in
on Sunday morning, because the assumption was you would sit in a church.
I see.
Right.
At a temple.
Right.
Or not go.
Not going was not an option. You would belong somewhere. So paradoxically, that has become that kind of assumption that you will have a community of faith, and that if you don't, there's something wrong with you, has really dissipated in our nation over the past years. Now it's not at all. It's not at all odd if somebody, I don't belong to a church, or I'm Catholic, but we haven't gone in years, that's a common thing. Paradoxically, then, for the people who do claim a faith, the faith you claim has increasingly become divisive on social issues. So if somebody says, I'm Catholic, well, we know where you stand on gay marriage, probably. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not, but we know where, at least where your church stands. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, if you say, yeah, I'm an Episcopalian, well, we know where you stand on these issues. Right. And kind of paradoxically, when you have more homogeneous groups of congregants who are choosing to be a member of your community because of your political stand, it's easier for you to as a religious leader to turn that into a group that you can get to lobby. So
that you can what?
Get to lobby or to organize for political purposes.
Doesn't that make you more overprotective of your set rules of functioning?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you become very intensely overprotective, almost like a parent. Mm-hmm.
And also, as you watch, and particularly for religious leaders, as your place in society kind of moves down the ladder, you want to try to recapture it. And so, it used to be that it was not a question that the pastors would be invited to you know, this particular thing, or their opinions would be asked about something. And now, that's less true. And so we try to create more spaces to get our voices heard in the public sphere.
I feel like religion has become so much more judgmental.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
That's what's dividing people. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, you know, they're making judgments about people. It's dividing people. It's forcing people to say, okay, then I'm against you too, or I'm against this. And that's, I think, those voices are becoming louder.
Yes.
Not only immigration, but in other.
Yes.
But I think that it's also a case of why so many young people don't come. Mm-hmm. Because we are divisive. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a protective instinct that kind of pushes us further that way than we used to be, maybe. Mm-hmm. But our young people have more diversity growing up than we did. Mm-hmm. And they object to this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, if you... the first book I'm aware of that studied this phenomenon was called Unchristian. Came out about 15 years ago, but the studies that they did has been replicated over and over and over again. This was the Barna Research Group. Did a survey of people who did not consider themselves Christian and asked them what they thought about Christianity. And overwhelmingly, the top three things that people who were not did not consider themselves Christian thought, when you said Christian, the words that came up for them were judgmental, homophobic, and misogynistic. Mm-hmm. And that was, and the more exposure that that somebody had to somebody, to people who called themselves Christian, the stronger that.
And those are educated people because they wouldn't have had that vocabulary.
Yes.
If they didn't, you know.
What was the name?
Unchristian.
I gotta tell Dennis about that.
Yeah, it's aged now, but it's the first one. It was the first kind of nationwide survey of, oh my gosh, look at this. Kinnaman, and I don't ask me how to spell it, but that was the name of the author.
But I know I have four kids that all grew up going to church. Mm-hmm. Some of them went to religious schools, high schools and colleges. Mm-hmm. And none of them go to church because they find it homophobic. Mm-hmm. And even when they were in high school, the misogynistic part bothered my sons.
And they are. I mean,
they are. My one son spoke up to a priest that was my boss about equal wages for their teachers, which I was one of them. And I said, when we got out of that little, it was just an informal thing. Mm-hmm. I said, for crying out loud, that's not the way to go about this.
Are they still Christians, though, your children? Do they believe in God, in Christ?
Not all of them.
Okay.
Some gave up entirely. It's a whole different story.
I think the kids are spiritual. I would like to say, because I have a gay son, so I do think that turned off my other boys. But one is scientific, so he, you know, there's like, oh, come on. But I think they're spiritual. I think they, and I think they're Christian. I wouldn't say they're not. But
I think a lot of people believe in God, but they don't follow the particular religion.
I think the sad thing is, especially, I can talk about the Catholic Church, you know, because they become more political, and they're lobbying, and they're, that's what's turning people off, because if they had just behaved the way they taught us to behave, just, you know, be the light of the world, go out there, you know, let people see how you are, and how you treat other people, but they're not doing that.
Well, when
separation of church and state.
Well, thank you, you teed that up for me nicely. So let's talk about the difference between being a person of faith in public life and allowing your faith to inform your decisions in the public square and your presence in the public square and religious activity in the public square.
And political activity.
So again,
what do we do?
So let's think about the difference between me as a person of faith allowing your faith to inform your political activities and your political positions and your presence in the public square. Differentiate that from religious organizations speaking to...
make it an individual rather than group.
Political issues, speaking in the public square in politics. On both sides, because the religious left is growing. For a long time, we talked about the religious right in this country, and they were very well organized, and to their credit, I mean, they got people to do things like go to central committee hearings and meetings and make sure that the candidates that were put up agreed with them. There's very little more boring than, you know, local central committee meetings.
But they seem to have a stronghold on Trump, the extreme right subset of the Republican Party.
That's a result of 20 years of getting your followers to do the groundwork at the grassroots level, when a lot of us were like, why would I do that? That's, you know, if you ever been to a local political committee meeting, they're the most boring things. Why would I waste my time that way? Well, if you want to influence... That's what you do. But now, as having seen that, there's a rise of progressive Christians. They call themselves the religious left, or other people call them that, saying, hey, you know, we should have, and the Episcopal Church is part of that, you know, we should be advocating our positions. I'm not sure the counterbalance to one is similar things on the other side of the political spectrum. But having said that, how do we as people of faith allow our faith to inform?
I don't think the Episcopal Church does that.
What?
Informs me.
About how you're...
I couldn't be in an organization.
Yes.
Like,
well, take the transgender issue that just came out now, where the judges said, you know. I think the thing is, how do you separate what you believe as a faith thing? That's let's say a faith does not believe in a transgender person. And just make it a state political, who's got rights, who's not, and take the faith thing out of it. I mean, just because you're a Catholic going to Congress doesn't mean you can use all your Catholic beliefs to make laws, I feel. You know, whether it's abortion, homosexual
birth control.
I mean, to me, those are faith issues. You know, we're supposed to be dealing with rights of the human being.
So as a citizen, if you're, say you're a person that does not believe in birth control, and abortion is the extreme part of birth control, but there's a lot of other birth control mechanisms, so, and you don't believe in any of that, but you are a citizen, and so you can vote, you can speak, but you have to respect other people that don't necessarily agree with you.
Well, the thing is, do you push your, those are Catholic beliefs, do you just not use birth control yourself, or do you force other people not to be able to use birth control because that's what you believe? That's the separation of the issue.
But let me make this more complicated, though. Let's put in one of our social justice themes, which is the option for the vulnerable.
Yes.
One of the things you're supposed to make decisions about is giving options to people who are vulnerable. Well, to put myself in, and I will quickly say I'm being the devil's advocate here because this is not what I believe, but if you believe that life begins at conception and that abortion is therefore killing a human being, then there is very little more vulnerable than an unborn child. How could you not, as a person of faith, argue to protect the vulnerable?
Well, you can argue, but you can't force it. I mean, for example, if you're a congressman, you know, you have to respect, you know, the population that you represent, and probably cast your vote the way the majority of your region would want you to.
Unless that is there.
Oh, of course,
But I still think it's where I think a teaching thing. You at least have these conversations. You know, I see the Catholic Church. I got a thing right away saying that governor was passing a birth abortion rights thing. They wanted us all to go to church and pray. And, you know, and that's all well and good. I would like them to educate people, to make people think before they do anything. But, you know, there was no call to action when the children were being separated. There was no call.
Right.
No, you know, I mean,
exactly.
It's not equal. It's not, you know, it's abortion. And it's, you know, like, let's spread this right to life
and
now.
And forcing your views on somebody who doesn't agree with your views doesn't seem fair or honest. Back in the 50s.
But you need to educate, I think. That's what, you know,
you could not get birth control if you went to a Catholic doctor.
It's the all-overarching thing, though. Everyone has the right to make their own decision.
Well, that depends. What do you think is the highest value? And this brings us back to social justice. And so this is a good place. Thank you again. you all tee this up for me so nicely. What is the high value? Is the highest value individual autonomy, individual agency, the right of the individual to make their own decisions about their own lives, faith, whatever, okay? Is that the highest value? In which case, and this is the debate in America, in which case we advocate for laws that impinge on the right of the individual as little as possible to allow us to have a safe society? Or is the highest value protection of the vulnerable?
So both of those, the right to life, or the right to choice, and the gun rights, they both come under that.
They could,
Or is the highest value what we tend to call the common good? The thing that is the most good for the most number of people.
This is the last discussion, isn't it?
Yes.
That you have these individuals.
Yes.
As in a perfect world, you could allow the individual to choose,
right?
Because they would make good choices.
You have stressed that in the Episcopal Church, you know, you don't tell us what to do or what to believe.
That's right.
We have room for entering our personal views with the teachings of the church.
Yeah.
So I think it has to include the right of the individual, but also looking at the rest of society. That has to be a mix in there. And I don't think it's what everybody believes, but I think what is ethical, how do you get that in there?
Right.
Like when you're talking about the new law, the right to choose or the right to life division, which is such. It's programmed to be a very stark division. The truth is, everybody that I know personally that's involved in right to choose, none of them would have had abortions given the opportunity. They just want, feel it would be very nice to have the right to make a decision about my body, myself, without some man legalizing or delegalizing what happens to my body. Should I have a baby? Should I not have a baby? What are my circumstances? How did all of this happen?
And I feel we couldn't possibly know everyone's circumstances.
No.
I mean, to think about why women would have an abortion, I don't know, and you know, to make that decision for a woman.
If you've never starved and if you've never lived in violence, how do you know what that feels like?
I mean, are women already who have 10 children?
Yes.
Well, are there women who have abortions for birth control?
Yes. Sure.
I'm sure there are.
But facts are
not necessarily.
But if you have other birth control, you have to have abortions.
You have a better method.
Well, and facts are interesting things.
Yes.
You know, when we have the right to life, right to choice debate, the cases that always get thrown out are the, you know, late term. Well, and you know, you look at it and you say, well, 92% of abortions that happen in the United States happen before 14 weeks of pregnancy. So think about, you know.
Yes, and is this person 13?
Right.
Or is this person 28 and a consensus?
But you know, is there a consensus that 14 weeks of pregnancy that child is far from being viable? You know, and then 2% of abortions happen by week 20 of pregnancy. So you add that in, and you're at 92% of abortions happen before week 20 of pregnancy. So you're talking, you know, relatively early, and certainly before you have a child that is viable. Of the remaining 8%, let's look at those. How many of them is the child already not viable? That the child will not live? How many of them are is the pregnancy putting the life of the mother at risk? You know, how many of those fall into those circumstances? My sense is that as a nation, we kind of have a broad consensus that we may not do it ourselves, we may not be happy with it, but that kind of first trimester, 12, 14, 15 weeks, is even people who, I know people who are rabidly anti-abortion who would say all abortion is murder, none of it, but I don't think most people are there.
No, I don't think so either.
I think most people are at, that's a reasonable point for the woman to be able to decide with her doctor that.
I have a friend who does know me, and she, we were talking. She said she would never participate in an abortion, but once a woman had, the process had started, she certainly would take care of them. But she said, you know, we all think they should, if they're going to make a decision, make it early. But she said sometimes some of these women don't find out the problem for like 4 months.
Yes.
They do amniocentesis. So now you're at 16 weeks.
Right.
Yes.
Then they have to make a decision. And, you know, that's a private decision.
Like, that's
That's a hard thing. Now you've been feeling like they
But it is you and it is your body. Mm-hmm. And why can a panel of men decide that you can or can't do something?
That's why I think the individual decision has to be tempered with ethics.
Ethics is tempered by power.
And are the ethics different at 34 weeks of pregnancy than they are at 2 weeks?
Well, we have to consider, as you all said, the situation. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, how much care, if women are giving birth to children, how much support is there afterward?
Yes. Exactly.
You know, you want women to have their children, and a lot of women are probably deciding to do it. But where's the support for them afterwards? The money to help them, the agencies to, you know, be there for them.
Inner city single mother.
We live 10 miles from a city where half the children grow up in poverty. So.
You know, and that's not a reason for abortion.
No, it's not.
But it's a reason for.
For us to get in there and help them.
There's an argument not to keep changing the subject, but this new editorial Cortez, I can't remember, but she's talking about that a society, how I think she says it's immoral for a society to have billionaires, and she's not saying the billionaires are immoral, she's saying a society that produces billionaires, when you have half the population living in poverty. That's an interesting discussion, because she wants to tax people who, over your dollar over $10 billion would be taxed.
Yes. So and so that
part then. Oh.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes. It's like a yes. Your everyday citizen.
Yes. Yes. Differentiated taxation that you pay this rate for this amount of money and this rate for this amount of money and this rate for this amount of money, and when you've made $10 billion, $10 billion and one and up,
then we're going
to
tax it.
And the other way to talk about that is, and some of these things are making the rounds too, is where is the what is the ethical division of paying executives over workers. So should the executives make $20 for every dollar the worker makes? Should the executive make $30 for every dollar the worker makes? In the United States right now, corporate executives make $745 for every dollar the worker makes. Is that ethical?
Yeah.
And if not, then what do we do about it?
It's not in our sphere, though, is it?
Well,
business.
I mean, laws in our laws in our sphere. Tax policies in our sphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tax policy is something that our representatives vote on. So.
Regulations, estate tax, all those things that allow people to keep their money and to have these billions.
Okay, that's a really good place to stop. Because it's 11 o'clock.
Can I just say it? Two things I read in the paper about Cuomo's abortion thing, that abortions, I don't know anything about it, but apparently it's a crime. But he wants to move it into the health and safety aspect.
Yes.
And also that he wants to put something in the Constitution that it's up to the woman to have power over her own body. No one's going to tell her what to do. I don't know how.
I didn't read the whole thing, but it's been passed.
It was passed because they were.
Well, the constitutional amendment hasn't been passed. That takes more. But the law has, the New York State abortion law was originally passed in 1970. And so that was before Roe versus Wade. And so this is, what he's attempting to do is update our statute so that even should Roe versus Wade be struck down, that the rights that it provides would be allowed to happen in New York State.
Thank goodness we live in a state like that.
Well, you know, not everybody lives in New York, but...
No, we're coming here.
Yeah. All right. So, next week, we do not have Bible study because I will be at Clarence Schools participating in public policy. It's the school strategic planning meeting that meets once a year. So, no meeting next week. When we pick up in February, let's look at the ethical decision of what does it mean to preference the agency of the individual versus what does it mean to preference the common good? Okay.
Now, what do you mean by the agency?
The right of the individual to make their own decisions.
Okay.
Say it
again.
The agency of the individual versus the common good. Wow. Okay. And you can come with the position that the agency of the individual is the common good, but I'm going to ask you to defend it. Okay? So that's something for you to think about for the next 2 weeks.
It sounds like a narcissist.
So,